This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Before his death from prostate cancer in 1993, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member Frank Zappa spent time in jail for making an obscene recording requested by undercover cops, released 60 albums in every genre imaginable, became one of the first modern musical artists to start his own company, testified before Congress that labeling music due to lyrical content was an attack on free speech, and inspired Václav Havel and others fighting Czechoslovakia's repressive communist regime. He packed a hell of a lot into 52 years, and he made a lot of waves and enemies along the way. Zappa is the subject of a new documentary by Alex Winter, whose previous films include Downloaded, a study of Napster and unauthorized file sharing, Deep Web, a look at Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road, and Trust Machine, an exploration of how blockchain technology decentralizes power. I interviewed him about Trust Machine in 2018. Go to reason.com to find that podcast. In Winter's documentary, Zappa comes across as a charismatic genius who is maddening and awful to the people around him. It's a complicated portrait of an indelible character who acted as a sort of transitional life form from the Cold War to the 60s and 70s counterculture to the technologically enabled yet sensorial world in which we live today. Zappa, says Winter, who's also known for his acting in the Bill and Ted series and other films, matters because he was an extremely talented composer, but also because he was very anti-authoritarian, very anti-fascist, very pro-citizens' rights. He also saw the tech revolution coming. In all of these extremely interesting ways, says Winter, Zappa was ahead of the curve. Although his politics, like his music, defy easy or really any categorization, Winter says that Zappa's overriding beliefs in free speech, individualism, and entrepreneurship carried strong libertarian connotations. He talks with me about Zappa's life and legacy, including internal contradictions regarding sexual freedom, his ultra-critical attitude toward hippies and drugs and other matters. Winter also tells me about his own oeuvre as a documentarian and weighs in on a possible pardon for Ross Ulbricht, the founder of Silk Road, whom Donald Trump is reportedly considering for a pardon or commutation. Ulbricht, says Winter, bore the brunt of moral and social panics over both the internet and Bitcoin, and was sentenced for far longer than his crimes deserve. I think he should not be in jail anymore, says Winter, full stop. Here is The Reason Interview with Alex Winter. Alex Winter, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
So let's start with who was Frank Zappa and why does he matter now?
Well, Zappa was a extremely prolific musician, composer. He fit at the time into, if you had to put him in a bucket, which he resisted vigorously during his life, he was thought of, when I grew up, largely as a rock and roll guitar player and musician, but who also had a barbed wit. His songs often had extremely satirical lyrics, but the music itself was very sophisticated and very difficult to play. So there was always these dichotomies about him. But then layered on top of all of that was this deep civic sense about him. He was very engaged with the times in which he came up, the sexual revolution, political movements, fighting for voting rights and for citizens' rights. And so I knew him as a child of the 70s as much as a cultural titan as I did as a rock musician. In fact, I think my way into him was more growing up from the cultural side than the music side. I didn't really get Zappa until I was out of college. But I think he matters now because two reasons. A, because he was an extremely talented and composer, and he matters. And he matters to the arts community, and I think that he matters to the rock community and the classical community. But also because he was very far ahead of his time in terms of dealing with where government was going, rise of far-right nationalism. He was very anti-authoritarian, very anti-fascist, and very pro-citizens' rights. But he also saw the tech revolution coming. So in all of these extremely interesting ways, Zappa was ahead of the curve.
So Zappa, he was born in what, 1940, I think, and then died in 93?
He died in 93, 52 years old, just before his 53rd birthday.
And he, it's fascinating. He's kind of a transitional life form. I think of him, he, in the 80s, he came to me, or he showed up in my site. He had a couple of, like a novelty hit, Valley Girl, which featured Moon Unit Zappa, his daughter. But then he became the spokesman against something called the PMRC, a kind of force of censorship coming out of the wives of a bunch of Washington senators. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And he was this clear-eyed, weird-looking, wonderful guy who was like, hey, you know, we live in a democracy. We should be able to speak freely and buy and sell records that don't necessarily have warning labels on them. We'll get to that in a second. But he's this transitional life form from a kind of, you know, pre-Cold War, or early Cold War to post-Cold War, became a hero in Czechoslovakia for reasons that I think we'll get into. I guess I want to start by talking. So he was born in Maryland, and he grew up at early stages. And the documentary is powerfully rich in showing he grew up near a military base. His father worked for the Department of Defense, where they made poison gases and things like that. So he was haunted. He grew up in a house where people had gas masks in their basement in case mustard gas canisters leaked and things. And like, obviously that has a huge impact on you as a kid to be living in a world where, you know, the Cold War and the bomb is everywhere. Ends up in California. And to talk about early tech adoption, he ended up after a series of adventures or misadventures, he owned a recording studio, and he was asked in a sting operation to put together a kind of like sexy audio tape for a bachelor party. What happened and how did that affect his subsequent life?
He moved around a lot. So he started out near Baltimore, and then he was very sick as a kid, asthma, all kinds of things. And his dad worked in various guises, almost, you know, more like a math and chemistry teacher ultimately, but did some work for the DOD. And they ended up in Lancaster, just outside of LA. And then he had the Studio Z when he was young, just out of, high school and in his early 20s. And he talks in the film about being viewed as a long-haired freak. But if you see photos of him from that period, which we show, his hair is extremely short.
Yeah. I mean, it's shorter than either of ours. I mean, but he jokes about that, saying like, I had hair that was, I think, shorter than the Beatles, but I'm still a long hair. And it's like.
So that's the era and that's the locale, which tells you a lot. And he set up this recording studio, and he was very creative, and he was also very entrepreneurial. He was, I think, outwardly not really very freakish. He was very single-minded and industrious, and he put ads out for his recording services. But, you know, the law enforcement in that region did not like him. They saw him as a blemish on their community, and they set up a sting operation to entrap him, and they did. He was in dire need of money. He had no money. He was like surviving on macaroni and cheese and crackers. And they offered him a few hundred dollars to make this tape, and they basically made this extremely unribald, very dry, he and a couple other people at a studio. And the cops burst in, and they brought him up on indecency charges, and they reduced a six-month to a year-long sentence down to 10 days in jail. And it was I would say when I was researching Zappa, it stood out to me as being a seminal moment for him, because he was a pretty isolated kid and wasn't that plugged in to what was going on in the world around him because of where he lived. And I think it really showed him the culture in which he lived and where he fit into that culture as kind of an enemy just by standing stock still And I think that influenced him greatly moving forward and ultimately influenced many decisions he made, including dedicating himself to making art, but dedicating himself to making art and make a living and remain independent.
Yeah, it's, so if we move forward just a couple of years, he ends up in Los Angeles. And this is right around the time, I mean, it's pre-Summer of Love, but it's mid-60s. The Sunset Boulevard strip scene is happening. What later became known as freaks were showing up. And Zappa was a huge part of that. I mean, he dressed oddly and flamboyantly, and then he was putting on musical shows with a group that he put together called the Mothers of Invention. I mean, he inherited a band and then turned it into his own. You know, talk a little bit about Zappa's first couple of records and how they kind of encapsulated not only what he was doing, but the shifts that were going on in American society.
Well, it's funny because by the time he hit the Sunset Strip with the Mothers, he had legitimately long hair. You could see there was an act of defiance, like, okay, you're going to throw me in jail for 10 days for having short hair. Well, now I'm going to be a freak, and you can live with that. And Freak Out, which was their album that they first launched with once they hit the strip, was a seminal record in many ways, and immediately put him on several maps. It didn't make anybody rich, and it didn't put anyone on the cover of Rolling Stone, but certainly anyone in the music industry, including the Beatles, were very taken by that album. And there were some extremely sophisticated recording techniques used to make that album. And again, no one was making any money. But it also, I think, planted a flag in the sand that he was an iconoclast legitimately, that he had his own voice musically, he had his own ideas lyrically, he was very plugged into the culture. You have to remember that in the mid-60s, he was one of the very first artists to live in Laurel Canyon, and he was one of the first people to kind of spearhead that movement. The Tom Mix Cabin, where he and his wife Gail lived, was a salon for all of the great music artists of the day. They loved Zappa, Bowie, Jagger. They would all come and hang out there for days on end. So he was sort of at the forefront of that movement, forefront of the sexual revolution in the music world, and then very plugged into the culture around him. I don't think he was that politically sophisticated yet. I think that started to grow as he spent more time there and in New York. But he was certainly, intellectually and artistically a very vibrant person who was at the center of a scene.
Yeah, it's amazing when I, in order to prepare for this, I went back and I listened to Freak Out, which I think is widely considered the second double rock album released after Dylan's Blonde on Blonde. And when you listen to it, it is an incredible pastiche of all sorts of things. It's kind of absurdist theater as well as all sorts of types of music all flowing into one another. And you start to, in the same way that I don't know about you, when I listen to something like the Velvet Underground's first record, and maybe stuff by like the Silver Apples or something, you're like, holy cow, this stuff was being done at the time when the Beatles, you know, were still doing Yellow Submarine or something. Like, it is so part of the time and so ahead of the time, and it's really striking. And that's true of his early oeuvre. How would you characterize? I mean, now we're flashing forward. He released something like 60 records, I think,
yeah,
or 40 records during his lifetime.
60, over 60.
How would you characterize it? Because it's, you know, he touches almost all forms of modern popular music.
Well, I mean, the thing I love about Zappa, and that struck me, I mean, my first awareness of him was the Saturday Night Live appearances that he had. He had a couple of those in the 70s. And that was our church. We all sat around as a family or with your friends and watched SNL when you were, you know, in the 70s. And
I can remember, I apologize for busting it on your memory, but I was, I can remember at one point rehearsing, this would have been 78, 79, something like that, rehearsing a play, a version. My high school was putting on The Sound of Music. And we stopped to watch Saturday Night Live on Saturday night, because that's what you did. So there were a bunch of people dressed like the Von Trapp family and Nazis hunkered around a TV. Yeah, because that's what you did. And Zappa was an early musical guest and then a musical guest and host on the show.
Right.
How did he capture your attention?
I think that he immediately stood out. And I think that, you know, you were talking about the Beatles, and I sort of relate this back to how they must have perceived him as well. I think that if you look at Pet Sounds and you look at Freak Out, two seminal, ostensibly California albums that heavily impacted the Beatles and other artists around them at that time, I think Zappa's contribution to that was what struck me and many of us in this. I was, albeit later, because I was a baby and when Freak Out came out, was that here was a man who was clearly talented as a musician, who was making extremely sophisticated music, who had extremely sophisticated ideas about recording techniques. And yet there was an intense vein of humor that ran through his music. He was experimenting with all these different genres. There's classical tropes, there's rock tropes, there's jazz tropes, there's like Spike Jonze and Ernie Kovacs references in there. But he's using all of those genres in a very dexterous way. It's not just a mélange. It's not just a pile of noise. It actually works. And I think that if you listen to Freak Out, if you're a fan of music, I think it's this thing that it shouldn't work, but somehow it does. And I think that really caught everyone's attention. I think for myself, watching him on SNL, it wasn't necessary. I was a really big fan of music that had humor when I was a kid. I loved Tom Lehrer. I loved Spike Jonze. I liked things like Ernie Kovacs. I liked his humor, but I was definitely kind of disoriented by the juxtaposition of that kind of humor against this extremely sophisticated compositional technique, which I wasn't old enough to know that's what it was. I just knew that it confused the hell out of me, and yet it was good. So I think it caught everybody's ear, but it didn't make him famous or, you know, ostensibly terribly successful. It took a beat before that began to take hold.
He was also, he's a phenomenal individualist, which I think, and I know Reason's audience, which tends to be libertarian, will appreciate him for that. I mean, he is just one of a kind for sure, a nonconformist, but he's also a contrarian. And this is something that you see a lot in kind of 60s counterculture and 70s counterculture. So for instance, he was kind of defined what a hippie might look like, but in fact, he hated hippies and was absolutely anti-use of drugs, not necessarily banning them. Can you talk a little bit about the internal contradictions in him and how that makes him more interesting?
Yeah, I mean, you said something at the top that I think is significant, which is that he was a kind of a transitional figure. That's one of the things that made me want to make a film about him. So, you know, as a documentarian, you're obviously largely interested in history and where people fit in their times, or, you know, I am anyway. and his transitional arc was always interesting to me, which is that you had someone who came up in a very conventional Italian-American family, patriarchal and old-fashioned and, or, you know, of its time. And yet Frank was a very radical thinker, and yet he also wasn't. He really was representative of the family in which he grew up, and he was representative in many ways of the times in which he grew up, but he had these kind of internal contradictions, which are, I think, inherent in most human beings. I don't think anyone's that concretely one way or the other, but they were fascinating because he was, at one hand, he was a freak, and on the other hand, he was very, I wouldn't say conservative, but very specific about the way he viewed the world, the way he viewed drugs, the way, you know, he didn't want his musicians getting, you know, high and screwing up playing his music. But he didn't like the lifestyle either. It wasn't just that he didn't feel they could play his music. You know, he famously rebuked Bill Graham, many attempts to get him to come up to San Francisco because he was openly loathed the hippie movement and wanted nothing to do with them and didn't want to be around a bunch of acid head hippies. And he also was somewhat disparaging of the New York art scene and its junky ethos, and other aspects of it, that he thought.
And in some ways he was, sexually libertine, and in other ways he was kind of like an old school Italian dad.
He was. I think that was a real conflict for him. I didn't want to try to shine too hard a light on it from a judgment standpoint with the film, because he's not around to speak for himself. But I could say, tell you that, like, doing the research, I found a man who was split in many directions. He wanted this ideal. He had the armchair in the basement. He wanted to be the kind of patriarchal Italian dad. And yet he was often on the road just, you know, having sex with whoever was available, you know, every night, and then coming home and being the dad again. So he didn't commit himself to, there are rock and roll artists who did commit themselves to one of those identities or another quite concretely. Right. Zappa never really did.
That's, I another way that he strikes me as really fascinating and a kind of mess of contradictions or just, you know, disparate forces is he also was a, he was a very creative person who believed that the artist should have ultimate control, but he was also an entrepreneur who, took control of everything that he owned and kind of forced it on other people. Talk a little bit about the ways, he exploded all sorts of musical forms, what a concert could be. I mean, his shows were more like happenings than they were traditional concerts. But then he also became one of the pioneers in popular music, certainly, of owning your fate in a way that he is, he was prescient in a way that I don't think anybody would have recognized in the late 60s or 70s.
Yeah, Zappa had a really good business mind. And I think that it was cultivated. I think he must have had some kind of a knack for it, but it was also cultivated. And also he got a lot of help from Gail, his wife, ultimately. But I think from his jail experience on, I think he made a commitment to having control over his own destiny as an artist. And he also knew that he needed to eat. And one of the things I really loved about Zappa that I absolutely wanted to focus on in the film that I think is often overlooked, especially in the rock world where so much is hyper-mythologized, and and it happens in the film world too, just this notion of artistic purity and that you can just somehow do your thing without needing a roof over your head or food. And Zappa was very transparent about how much his concerts cost to launch, how much his albums cost, what he made, what he needed to make and wasn't making, how to make up for that shortfall, how bad the record industry contracts were, how badly artists were being screwed. Towards the end of his life, he saw the digital revolution coming. He knew that artists needed to be able to protect their digital content moving forward. He was very vocal about that towards the end of his life. So I think it was a practical concern, but I also think it fit with his ethos of if I'm going to live a life in which I'm exploring myself artistically, I have to be willing to pay the consequences for that and deal with how to survive financially and how to help my family eat and keep a roof over their head. And there's just very few artists I can think of that were that open and honest about that experience.
Yeah, he reminded me, I had always heard about Henry Fonda, that Henry Fonda would do a commercial movie, make a bunch of money, and then he could do a play or a small movie that he wanted. And there are multiple moments in the documentary, which I find fascinating, where he says, like, I'll take the money that I made having a hit or a semi-hit and then put it into a passion project. He owned he created a record label. He was one of the first rock stars to do that and then gained control. He also, if I'm not mistaken, he also sold his catalog to Rykodisc, which was a CD-only label early on, which gave him a pile of money and a huge amount of freedom. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than that, but that is accurate that they sold to Ryko, but it got caught up in a legal dispute with Warner's, and Gail spent the better part of her latter years in her life battling Warner Brothers. Oh,
yeah, which is, of course, was bad because he had gotten away from Warner Brothers.
He had, yeah.
Sells to Ryko, and then Warner Brothers buys Rykodisc.
So. Exactly.
But the idea is that he was always looking for ways to finance
absolutely
his freedom. And there's a couple of great, and you don't hear a lot of this in artistic pursuits because people want to kind of mystify the money that goes into this, but where he went to England and paid for a British orchestra, an English orchestra, to play his music. And he was talking quite frankly about, okay, well, it was expensive, but they did it exactly the way I wanted because I was paying them. Yeah, and then it's an interesting kind of thing too, because, and I'm curious if you think he was being fully honest, he said he did most of these things for himself. He wanted to have his music played exactly the way he wanted. He wanted to have it recorded so that he could enjoy it. And that's kind of, I mean, he's starting to sound like, you know, the musical, if Ayn Rand had written The Fountainhead about a rock star, it would have been Frank Zappa. I mean, he's like Howard Roark or something like that. But do you think, I mean, obviously he believed that, but then was he at all mad that he never achieved the massive popular success that many people who were less talented than him had?
I'm not sure. I certainly couldn't speak to him. I could speak to this notion that he was only doing it for himself, because I can't say that he didn't, that it was completely disingenuous, but you're talking about someone who was very, very concerned about the audience from the very beginning of his career, even before he was a musician. He was extremely aware of the artist's, and he talked about this a lot, the artist's responsibility to give something to the audience, and that you're servicing the audience. And he, you know, when Freak Out came out, he moved to New York. The album did okay. The band wasn't doing great. He moved to New York, but he didn't do what the Beatles did. He didn't take up residence in a club and just tunesmith workshop hits. He just hung out in a theater and they just did theatrical happenings, as you called them, all day for months. And what that told me about him was that he was cultivating a relationship with the audience. He was very, very engaged with them and what initiated certain responses in the audience. So I would say that his quote that we put in the film, we put it there for a reason, where he says, you know, I'm only doing this for myself. All I care about is myself. Well, I mean, he basically is dying of cancer and puts every ounce of energy he has at the end of his life into mounting these concerts for people to perform the music in a way that he thinks will have an impact on them. And it does, and it's very moving, and he dies very soon after that. And I think that we didn't want to, you know, be too on the nose about it, but I think it tells you how moved he was by his relationship to the audience and by the adoration that he did get and his ability to finally, towards the end of his life, get at least that kind of music played properly.
You know, it's another way he was prescient or transitional. If you're over 40, probably, certainly if you're over 50 like I am, you used to go to rock concerts and you had no idea if the band would show up or if they would make it through more than one song, if that. And his insistence on his band actually being rehearsed and straight and able to play, that's the norm now. And it's like funny because, I don't know, like probably the first dozen concerts I went to, somebody passed out on stage or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And that was
or
the end of the 3 show.
3 o'clock in the morning, maybe you realize they probably weren't coming.
In the 80s, he went through, and I want to talk about his 80s are really kind of interesting. His 1980s, I guess mine as well, probably yours. Two major things there that are taken up in the film. And the first is this notion of kind of record labeling, and that is a form of censorship. The Parents Music Resource Center was this group that was run by Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife, and Jim Baker, a senator, and Jim Baker's wife. And they became this huge cause in the mid-80s. This was, I guess, you know, MTV had emerged. Prince, the song Darling Nikki, which you have a brief clip of people talking about that, was considered so pornographic and obscene that along with that and a couple of Cyndi Lauper songs, She Bop, a bunch of heavy metal songs that had satanic imagery, we had actual hearings about rock music or pop music lyrics in the Senate. I mean, and I was watching this with my girlfriend last night, who's a bit younger, and it is like Rock and Roll High School, the Ramones movie, you know, parody movie or something from. It's just insane. What was the PMRC and how did Frank get to the forefront of that? Because he was one of the few people in popular music who was willing to say, what the fuck is wrong with you people? You know, you shouldn't be censoring speech in a democracy.
The Parent Music Resource Center, if I'm not committee or whatever, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. It was a group of largely of women, wives of several major Beltway people, Tipper Gore, and I mean it was left and right of the political aisle. It was not a partisan group, but they were unified in their fear of popular music destroying the social fabric of their youth. And look, Zappa did not think he was going to be one of he thought there was going to be an army showing up at the Senate. And he got there and it was him and Dee Snider.
And John Denver.
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
That is like showing up, I mean, like, you know, in a Lord of the Rings battle and you're expecting the whole army and it's John Denver.
Yeah.
Dee Snider and Frank Zappa. It's like, okay, let's cut a piece right now.
Yeah, I'm sure that in the Senate they were just laughing and thinking, well, this will be over quickly. But Zappa's, I mean, frankly, they all were. Snyder did an amazing job as well. They were very eloquent and firm. We didn't put a lot of it in the film, but it's all kind of on YouTube and such. Zappa's testimony is really, really impressive. Like, it's basically a 6-page manifesto about the importance of the Constitution, and he understands it, and he's not just spouting the founding fathers crap you hear today without any real understanding of the substance of it, and about citizens' rights and about the importance of art and culture and about people's, you know, the need for people to be able to think for themselves, and he adds solutions. And it's interesting because in retrospect, a lot of people look at those hearings as a failure because they ended up with the advisory sticker. But the fact is what the PMRC was trying to do was censor content at its root. So to end up with an advisory sticker, which became basically a badge of honor for any artist who wanted to appear legit, it was a huge victory and an enormous setback for this sort of autocratic notion of policing culture in such a ludicrous way. And we find ourselves, you know, in a similar time. I'm sure Zappa would have been very vocal with what's going on now. But it did, I think, put him on the map in terms of a certain generation who may not have come to him in the 70s or even, you know, in the early 80s, who suddenly realized he was out there battling for them. He was very eloquent, very accessible, very smart, and hilarious. And he made great music. So I think it woke a lot of people up to him, actually.
Yeah. And related to that, he was a hero, as we've mentioned, he was a hero in Czechoslovakia, Vaclav Havel, the imprisoned playwright who became the first president of Czechoslovakia after the communist government was demolished, invited him over and had a friendship with him. A song of his, Plastic People, gave the name to a great dissident band in Czechoslovakia, which I actually think is what one of the things that Havel first wrote about, their kind of imprisonment or banishment. And this is an interesting thing where it's less about any specific politics. Certainly the Czechoslovakian people didn't care, you know, about Frank Zappa's views about, the level of government spending or minimum wage or regulation. Right. But he was such an individualist and such a critic of his own society. He obviously was a big inspiration. Talk a little bit about his intersection with the end of international communism.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And I think that it has, it was similar to my own interest in him politically, was that he, just like he rose above genre, and I don't mean in some kind of heroic or superhuman way, I just mean in terms of his desire to be true to himself as best as he could. Just as he rose above genre, he didn't really fit into any particular political bucket, and a lot of people claimed him. He certainly was closer, I would say, to a lowercase libertarian in that era. I don't know what he'd make of some of them now. I don't know what he'd make of either any of the parties, sort of basic parties now either, for that matter. I think that Zappa was at heart anti-authoritarian, very pro-individual liberty, but he was also, he was not super anti-government. He just was anti-government corruption and malfeasance and very pro-citizens' rights. So I'm saying all this because that could be layered on top of what happened in Czechoslovakia quite easily, what they were fighting against and this notion of just being suppressed as well as oppressed. Zappa's music just cut clean through all of that from the very get-go. And I think so his music crossed boundaries in ways I think surprised him. And when Havel invited him over, I think he was aware he had a fan base over there because he tracked where people were buying his music from a financial standpoint and a touring standpoint. But I don't think he was at all prepared for the hero's welcome that he got. I mean, there were thousands of people at the airport. They all knew who he was. They knew his music intimately. And he really was a symbol of freedom for them. And he was very much a symbol of the Western menace for the police state, during the communist era, which helped him a lot at this time. So, but I think that it was genuine. I don't think that, like a lot of rock and roll artists at that time, they would just spout sort of these kind of bullshit cliches about peace or about freedom and they wouldn't really live it, and they didn't really mean it. They didn't really know anything about these things. They really were just capitalists who were trying to get more kids to buy their records. Zappa really did. I mean, his album, the lyrics, and he put his money where his mouth was, and I think that spoke to people as well.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And again, this, you know, thankfully, that world is mostly gone, but where you would have the odd moment of Frank Zappa being kind of, you know, grilled in front of Congress in the U.S. and then being hated by like Soviet or communist apparatchiks because he was a threat to the regime. And it's kind of like, okay, he's clearly doing something right if he's, you know, if he's in touch with the authorities in the West and in the communist East. It's, you know, that there were those moments when the Soviets were banning rock and roll, or Castro was banning rock and roll, and people in America were, you know, burning Beatles records. It's like, yep. You got to trust the music at that moment. Well, let's talk a little bit about your career and kind of like the way that, you know, Zappa kind of illuminates some trends in your life that seem to be very interesting impression of the moment. First off, this documentary started as a Kickstarter, or you started funding it on Kickstarter, and you got what was at the time, I don't know if it still is, the single largest, you know, kind of cash of money of donations at Kickstarter. Talk a little bit about that. And, you know, sure. Is that Zappa-esque or what?
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the things that attracts me to Zappa is this idea of the artist who is also engaged with their time politically, who is also entrepreneurial to the degree that you figure out a way to make your life work while you make your art, not really caring so much about the public's or your industry's perception. I really relate to that. I came from, my parents were modern dancers who had companies and worked by the seat of their pants, and, you know, also built a family and kept a roof over our head. I came up as a child actor, and then as an actor, and then as an independent filmmaker, and I've always been scrapping my way along to build a life for myself and my family. And I'm very aware of how you budget your art and how that works and the realities of that against this ridiculous mythologizing you have to constantly come up against, where they want you to just be this magical spirit that just somehow floats through the world doing stuff. I was just, you know, so that intrigued me about Zappa greatly. And I did a Kickstarter campaign for my film Deep Web, which you know mm-hmm. well about Ross Ulbricht's Silk Road case. We raised a small amount of money for that. But what it allowed us to do was it allowed us to put a flag in the sand and say we're making the film, and it attracted a lot of sources, locked up certain IP, gave us some money to get the film made by creating a sizzle. And I'm saying this because there's real practical realities to this stuff. It's not just PR. And in the case of Zappa, it wasn't like people were banging my door down to make a Zappa movie. They really weren't. He's an iconoclastic, somewhat niche artist, and not the most commercial figure. So the Kickstarter helped us. It gave us the money to preserve his archive, which is what we did with that money. It planted a flag in the sand, raised a lot of awareness, ultimately helped us get the rest of the financing. It was an enormous amount of work. It was a couple of years of our lives, like day in, day out, to preserve this media and to raise that money. But it did allow us to get the rest of the film made. And each film is a battle in that way. Just, I think, like, to, you know, for Zappa, every album was a battle. It just doesn't stop. You just sort of roll your sleeves up and you go on to the next battle.
You're looking over some of your titles. There's Download, a work about unauthorized file sharing, Deep Web, which you mentioned, which is about Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road, Trust Machine, which I did a podcast with you about, which is about blockchain and Bitcoin. You did a fantastic documentary about the Panama Papers, which is one of the biggest hacks of all time. And not surprisingly, it's such a big hack, people have trouble even discussing it, I think, getting their arms around it. Is there, you know, is there a commonality to your work then, you know, in terms of, you seem to be very interested in this intersection of kind of technical innovation, cultural production, finance, and power. How do you see your vision of what you're interested in playing at?
Well, you know, you start in your own kind of little niche field when you're young. You know, I was mostly interested in film and theater and acting, but I was also very independently minded from the get-go. And So I immediately collided with the world of finance and politics, and then ultimately technology because of the era that we live in. And I discovered the internet quite young. When the internet was very young, it wasn't, the web hadn't even started yet. In the late 80s, I got involved in the BBS and Usenet era, and was very involved in the growth of online community. And it was clearly evident at that time that the world was about to change in huge ways that it was really not prepared for. And I saw that personally. I knew my industry was going to change in ways that it wasn't prepared for. And so that drew me to Sean Fanning and Sean Parker when they were working on Napster during the late 90s, early 2000s. I became quite close with Sean Fanning particularly, and very much admired what he was doing. I was not, unaware of the ethical quandaries, but like I said, I knew that the world was going to disrupt, and I knew that it was that the people who were doing the kind of work he was doing were so far beyond law and industry that it was going to take. And we're still not caught up. It's a mess. I mean, look at where we are today. So that has always fascinated me greatly, and I think for me it was a matter of you can pretend this world doesn't exist and just try to swim against a current, or you can actually get involved. And I just chose to get involved.
So to follow up a little bit on some of the tech and innovation and being beyond law kind of questions, Ross Ulbricht is in the news somewhat because along with people like Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, Reality Winner, and a few others, he has been, Donald Trump, I guess, himself has raised the possibility of giving Ross Ulbricht, the founder, convicted founder of Silk Road, some kind of clemency or a pardon. Do you think that's going to happen? And do you think it should happen?
Look, I am very close with Lynn. I've spoken to Ross quite a bit over the years, and I've been very vocal about his case. I am not a member of the quote free Ross movement, from the standpoint that I don't think it's even ethical from a directing standpoint and a filmmaker standpoint to get that sort of in bed with an activist movement. But I, from a moral standpoint, I think his sentence was inarguably unjust. I think it was both a drug war and a Bitcoin prosecution, and meaning the fear, the drug war sort of over prosecution. And Lord knows at that time, they thought Bitcoin was going to bring Wall Street to its knees. And they were clamping down on anything that got anywhere near the notion of cryptocurrency, which was ludicrous. But that's the world we live in. And I think that Ross found himself at the intersection of those two things and was grossly over prosecuted. And I said at the time, even if he was guilty of every single charge that they leveled at him, and I don't believe he was, I think there were certainly many crimes he committed, some of them egregious. I'm not going to sit here and try to paint him as a hero, but I think the kingpin charge, which really caused him the damage, is kind of ludicrous given the scale of what the Silk Road actually was. And that carried a lot of the weight in terms of the prosecution. And I think he should not be in jail anymore. Full stop. I think it's, he should not be. He's done enough time for those charges. Trump, I just could, it's the Wild West. Who knows? I'm not involved in that. It's not really my world in terms of the people who I'm close to. I don't have sources in that world. I've been pretty vocally oppositional to many of the people in that space. So I made it clear to Lynn, I may not be the most helpful person in your orbit at the moment, but I would love to see Ross out of jail. That's the long and short of it.
Do you, when you think about, you have kids, when you think about the world you grew up in and the world you're in now, the world they're growing up in, are you hopeful that, and maybe I might be projecting here, are you hopeful that technology and kind of cultural shifts will continue to open up kind of freedom and possibility and space for people to live in autonomous zones, whether they're temporary or longer lived or anything like that? Or are you, so I guess in a way, are you optimistic that the same kind of cultural and technological currents that brought you from wherever we all were in 1975 to 1985, you know, et cetera, all the way up to 2021?
I am absolutely a tech optimist. That doesn't mean I am evangelical about it. It certainly doesn't mean, in fact, I think that the more involved you are, and in many senses, the more optimistic you are, the more realistic you are about what's actually going on and what the actual threats are, as opposed to this finger wagging that we get that it's all bad, usually being dictated us by people who are online, you know, all the time, which we all right. are. It's sort of like yelling at water for being wet. So I think we're already in a world that is far more open and democratized because of technology. My son is on technology all day long now, given the pandemic. You know, I look back at Sean Fanning and the birth of online communities and all the development that went on in creating, in some ways, in some philosophical ways, meaning getting societies, global societies, more adjusted to this idea of being online at once. And then in some very dry technical ways, in terms of getting those systems to actually work. Napster was the first real-time, large-scale online community in the history of the world. By an order of magnitude, like far beyond anything that had existed before.
Yeah, it's fascinating. People, if it gets talked about at all, they forget that whole dimension, which was
that's what it meant.
Amazingly,
The direct line from Sean Fanning to Zoom, which is what has allowed everything about society to function today, including you and I having this conversation. And again, it doesn't mean, you know, it's a shame we even have to say these things with caveats, like it's not all good and there are downsides. Right. I mean, of course there are. It's obvious. You know, you can use a hammer to put up a painting or to bash someone's head in. It's, you know, just the way the tools work. But the reality is that we're already sitting in a much better world because of the ability to communicate, to end run certain forms of you know, autocracy or other forms of oppression. You'll never outrun, you know, hackers, the good hackers, the real term of the word, not the sort of Hollywood version of it. There will always be a step ahead. There will always be tools to create more forms of privacy. And the other thing that's good is that there are certain forms of legislation, certain things that are happening to keep people better protected. That's growing, albeit slowly. So I'm very optimistic about it. And I think the pandemic has proven the case that my son actually enjoys his classes. It's like he'd rather be out playing kickball, but he's not crying himself to sleep. He's getting an enormous amount out of the tech community that he has.
Right. Well, I guess as a final question, what's your favorite Zappa record? And it can't be a greatest hits.
A
40 CD box set.
I would never do that because I love Zappa's compositional brain. I loved he would plunge into something, he'd make a piece of art, and he'd get out on the other end of the pool. I would say Hot Rats is probably my very favorite mm-hmm. Zappa album. I think that I mean, I do like the orchestral stuff, the symphonic stuff, so I can listen to Yellow Shark all day. But when I think of Frank Zappa, and if someone put a gun to my head, it would be Hot Rats.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there before the gun is loaded.
Goes so, off. Yes.
Thank you, Alex Winter, documentary director, filmmaker, most recently of Zappa. Thanks for talking to Reason.
Great. Thanks, Nick. Good to see you as always.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts. And sign up there. Thanks for listening.